Turbines to power. Hey, there we go. Hey, folks, thanks for tuning into the Banff Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Lafferty. And today is our long-delayed and probably irrelevant Shazam slash Captain Marvel review podcast. With us today, we have frequent co-hosts Walt Rebilliard and Chris McLaughlin. How you guys doing?
I don't know.
And hey, Chris, how you doing?
Well, you know, I don't have to go to work all week long, and the people of Virginia are still paying me. Does it get any better than that?
Well,
you're living the dream.
That's cool. I am indeed.
Occasionally, you make me wish I worked in public education, and this is one of those times. And standing up on the left side of my screen, we have Alice Peng and Brandon Powers. How are you guys doing?
Hi, doing great.
You guys have standing desks?
Yes, we have standing sitting desks. They're hydraulic buttoned.
Oh, that's pretty cool. We have those in my office.
Sweet. You have robot desks?
Yes, we have robot desks.
That's amazing.
I'll have to show you, like, later on. Walt, we'll show you.
They look like they should be, you know, on the bridge of a Star Trek, I think.
I'm down. Just send one my way. It's fine. But until then, Shazam!
Shazam. All right. So, Walt, you have to leave, and, like, whenever your dog starts chewing on things, do you want to go first with any thoughts you have, or you haven't seen the movies yet? Or?
I haven't seen it, but it looks fun. And since it's a, you know, 100-year-old property, you're not going to spoil much. But, I mean, the from everything I've seen in the media, it looks like they've done a really good job of trying to tailor it to an audience that might not have seen Captain Marvel, Billy Batson before, because there's a lot of history to this character between the Fawcett comics and then DC comics and reboots and revamps and restarts. So, I mean, I couldn't imagine cobbling a script together. I mean, this is doing a Shazam movie was probably as difficult as somebody walking into a Hollywood exec office and saying, "We should do Hawkman."
So is he still traveling around the Southwest with an old man in an RV?
Shazam or Hawkman?
Well, Shazam.
I don't know.
Saw the Shazam Isis Power Hour in the 70s.
Of course we did. Okay. Well, I did. I was around. And let me tell you, that Billy Batson hairdo was stunning.
That was something. Well, hey, Chris, we haven't talked to you in a minute. It's been a while since you've been on the podcast. What are your thoughts on Shazam?
I skipped it. Believe me, as a fan of cinema in general, I am very, very, very convinced of the fact this is the only way this character was ever going to work in a movie in 2019. And I also respect the fact that, you know, them doing a Shazam movie and doing it this way is about the most anti-Zack Snyder thing you could do. And really, being as anti-Zack Snyder as you humanly and possibly could be, I think that's every American's moral and civic duty. So I salute them just for doing that. But the thing about it is the core conceit is that it's a little kid that's a superhero, and I am happily and militantly childless. You would be surprised how much 25 years in the classroom really gets any desire to have young people around you out of your system. So it's like, wow, I'm going to pay $20 to be locked up in a theater with a superpowered child. This feels like babysitting to me. And again, we've long established I'm a weirdo. I mean, other weirdos look at me and go, "That dude's a weirdo." But you know, my favorite version of the character, which should never, ever, ever be translated to any other media whatsoever, is the 40s version where Billy's a kid, but it never really matters that he's a kid. You know, in the 40s, you know, Billy has a job that, you know, pays better than mine. You know, he's a celebrity, and like people hand him, you know, like the keys to tanks. And, you know, I don't know if they let him drive, because I haven't read, you know, Fawcett comics are kind of hard to come by, but it wouldn't surprise me. And good Lord, if they hadn't been a little more sensitive to kids, I'm sure they'd have been handing Billy liquor and cigarettes, because nobody really seemed to be overly bothered by the fact he was a child. And that version of the character worked a lot better for me. But again, I would be the only one in the theater seeing that. So believe me, I salute Warner Brothers on their choices. So yes, there you go. My lengthy rant about a film I haven't seen.
Well, that's cool. That leaves us a segue over to Alex and Brandon, who are the only two people out of the five of us who have seen Shazam. So.
Okay. So I have a history with Billy Batson as a character. And I will tell you that I absolutely despise this movie. If it wasn't for the fact that it was a superhero movie, I would have walked out of that movie. The reason being is that you, like Walt said, and Mike has, and Chris has said, this is 100 years old almost. 1939 is when it came out. I was first introduced to it in the 90s through back issues from the 80s, that 70s and 80s. That's where I believe the back issues were. And the character really spoke to me because something, I, like you, Chris, Brandon and I don't have kids. We have no desire for kids. But for me, it says the character tells a person that no matter what happens to you in life, you should hold on to that childhood innocence. The core distinctions of that character for the past 100 years, most of the 100 years that it's been out, or 80 some years, is that he is a Boy Scout, that he is hopeful regardless, he's hopeful and sees, you know, the world through rose-colored glasses, and he is good to a fault. He's always curious. Well, the problem that I have with this movie is he had none of those traits. While I understand that they're trying to portray a kid that's relatable, he needed to maintain some of those traits. The hopefulness was gone. He had this air of, I got to look out for myself. I got to look out for myself. And yes, he transitioned during the movie and learned that it was not always all about him. But the character is chosen by the wizard because he has that soul, that innocent soul. And this character was far from that innocent soul. He was not a Boy Scout. He stole, he cheated, he lied. And that mortified me. That angered me because it doesn't teach the values that character does. And I understand that they wanted to make a darker movie. There are certain characters I feel DC can get away with using Warner Brothers and making these cinemas that are darker. Superman and Billy Batson are not not characters I think can do that at all. And in addition to that, and the reason why I don't think that mm-hmm. Brandon, I'll pass it to you because I got distracted.
I'd actually love to hear any people's thoughts on what she was just talking about. I know you guys haven't necessarily seen the movie, but, you know, she was addressing a lot of the comic origins and such of the character. And you guys probably know a lot about that.
Well, it was a stroke of genius that the people at Fawcett, Beck and Ray Boy and all great people working at Fawcett, they picked up on the notion that their readers were kids. And I think a mistake that's been made through a lot of media is people assume that kids want to watch other kids. I think I learned that lesson at 9 when I really got into Battlestar Galactica, and I was screaming at the TV during the scenes when Lauren Green, and you know, with the extinction of the human race at stake, would stop to talk to the little kid. It was Will Wheaton, I'm pretty sure. All right, his little robot dog. You know, just like I don't want to see these people. I want to see what the grown-ups are doing. You know, that they sort of picked up on the fact that you know, kids want to watch adults. They want to be adults. And to me, that was the heart and the appeal of the that was the reason the character outsold Superman back in the 40s. And it's a point well taken about Billy being you know pure of heart and sweet and just genuinely good. That's something that I thought, honestly, I think the best overall version of this character will probably be the Jerry Ordway series in the 90s, because to me it worked as a modern comic. It blend in nicely with the legacy things DC was doing in the 90s, but it kept the fact that he was at heart, just a genuinely good person at heart. So, you know, that's the, to me, the influences I see going on. Hello.
And,
we're still here. We're listening. Yeah.
Sorry. I was trying
quick
to
point. I really liked what you said.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Walt has left us. I think his dog was demanding a walk, but
that's a shame. The ratings say the dog is the most popular character with our listeners.
It's hard to compete with the dog. People love the dog.
He's our Fonzie.
He's the most popular character with me on the show.
If only I had a pet chimp, but I'm in agreement. My main exposure to Billy Batson and Shazam was in Kingdom Come, and before that, in some of the Giffen DeMatteis Justice League International stuff back in the 90s. So that's more the take on the character I always liked was, you know, the Big Red Cheese, the Big Boy Scout. So I'm kind of bummed that wasn't in the movie. They did a kid friendly version, The Magic of Shazam, a few years ago, that my son really liked, and was hoping to see the movie with him. But I understand there's a scene where a guy gets his head bitten off, so it might be a few years before we do that. So, hey Chris, you're kind of a comic book historian. Can you bring us up to speed on the whole Captain Marvel Shazam controversy thing, in entertaining fashion?
Well, during the 1940s, he was called Captain Marvel. He was only ever called Captain Marvel. They did comics called Captain Marvel Adventures, and that's the only thing he was ever referred to. And and he happened to come out at the time that there were a lot of legitimately rip-off of Superman characters out there, you know. And DC, I think in the Golden Age book, I wrote something like DC showed, well, excuse me, wasn't DC at the time, National Comics showed that their superpower was to file lawsuits at superhuman speeds. So they.
I remember that era.
Thank you. They leveled one at Fawcett, the people that were putting out Captain Marvel, and that thing drug on for like a decade. And I mean, if you have anything beyond a passing familiarity to the characters, you can't call the Fawcett Captain Marvel a ripoff of Superman. It's ridiculous. And it was pretty open, at least to me, pretty openly something driven by the fact that Captain Marvel was outselling Superman. But eventually, you know, superhero comics, they lost their luster after the war. They always did business with kids, but they were doing bigger business because they were available on military PXs. That's where I really need Walt. And soldiers were buying them. But after the war, they lost that sort of captive market and their sales collapsed. So by that time, you know, Fawcett wanted to get out of the business anyway. So they basically just surrendered because they thought, you know, what's the point of fighting for something that there's no money in anymore. And so they paid some damages, and they agreed to stop publishing them. And I think that DC inherited some of their titles, DC didn't inherit the titles, just that they agreed to stop publishing them. And that was the last you heard of that character until late 60s, and then Marvel realized that essentially that's an abandoned trademark, and if they could get a Captain Marvel into publication, the name would be theirs. So that's where they rushed out the Kree soldier coming to Earth version that just, you know, a offshoot of that just made a kajillion dollars at the box office. And I've actually read that first issue. Last summer I read all of Captain Marvel, the male dude version. I read his adventures start to finish, and I got to tell you, that first Captain Marvel issue, it's credited to Stan Lee, but it's the most hot mess thing that I have ever read that has Stan Lee's name attached to it. And yes, I know he did Stripperella as well. It's basically just like a middle finger traced onto every single page. It's the most hot mess of a character I've ever come across. It barely works for that one issue, and there's just nothing in this character that's gonna go to a continuing series with any degree of success. But having stolen the trademark, they had to keep publishing this character every so often, or DC could have gotten it back. So, with absolutely no demand from anyone, they kept bringing this character back. I think everybody in comics wrote him at some point. Nobody lasted more than like 3 or 4 issues, and everybody would inherit this mess of a character, and their answer would be to do a complete reboot of him. I mean, really, I think he lasted a total of like 40 some issues. If I had done a drinking game, you know, take a shot every time Captain Marvel gets rebooted, I would still be in an alcoholic coma a year later. It was just really that amazing. Well, DC decided to bring back the Fawcett version in the 70s, but by that time they couldn't call him Captain Marvel anymore. Marvel had stolen a march on them. So they had to call his comic Shazam, and then ever since then, they've been trying to nudge us in the direction of the rest of us calling him Shazam. And then finally, they took the inevitable step with the new 52. You got to have the exclamation point or it doesn't work. They finally officially called him Shazam. And by the way, also created my least favorite version of the character, like the hood wearing douchebag who shoots lightning bolts and is like, it's like all grimdark and serious.
If you read New 52 version, that's the version they made the movie out of. He at one point is doing a street show going lightning from my hands. And he's doing a street show for money into his guitar case.
Oh my God.
That is the version they did the movie on. And I want to throttle whoever decided it was.
Oh my God. I need to sit down. That knocked the breath out of me and I didn't even actually see it. Oh my God. They filmed that comic.
They did. And the scene where he's just on the steps and just doing the guitar case and doing lightning for my hands, I was just mortified. But they did the dark grim look out for numero uno, all the like very New 52 inspired Billy Batson. It made me so angry.
Well, hey, can we segue to a movie maybe people liked? Did you guys see Captain Marvel?
Yes! I'd actually like to just get a few thoughts out on the movie. There are different ones than Alice hit on. And they are a little bit involved of spoilers, if that's okay.
Yeah, go ahead. Spoiler warning. Spoiler warning. Okay, go ahead.
All right. So the movie starts off with the villain, and the whole thing involving the villain felt like a movie 20 to 25 years late. It really reminded me of a lot of this of superhero stuff that we would see back in the 90s. And it wasn't done that well. Dr. Savannah ends up teaming up with the seven deadly sins. My big problem with them is they could have been, you know, the seven ugly thugs or the seven dwarves of Snow White. Because being the seven deadly sins never did much. They didn't have any strong link to those sins other than occasional random references of, you know, oh, what's your sin? And, you know, if you're going to pull out the seven deadly sins that have been on the Rock of Eternity and held captive and now they're loose, I kind of expected there to be these massive changes in the world as those sins basically run rampant. But instead, Savannah just kind of holds them with him and pulls them out whenever he needs a thug fight. And it was just, to me, that was just such a waste of a concept there. To have those. Now, for me, I also did a Mutants and Masterminds Champions game where we were using the seven deadly sins and they were running rampant in the world and such. And so maybe that's just striking closer to what I've run and so the thoughts that I had. Overall, I agree with Alice. I definitely do think that it was the new 52 Billy Batson that they were presenting, which to me, I'm like, this is horrible. And after we watched the movie, I went on my DC Universe and went and read some Shazam comics. I did the four-part Superman Shazam First Thunder comic, which I thought was excellent and had that childlike innocence. And then I read a couple issues of the Power of Shazam from back in the 90s just to see, because I've read the new 52 Billy a little bit, and he's what made me quit the Justice League comic at the time. And so that was the version I'd actually read comics of, and I'm like, yeah, this is the character that I've always seen portrayed in other venues. And just as a random plug, I loved him in Young Justice, absolutely, because they did take that childlike character and present him in a way that was really enjoyable, and I wish that there had been more episodes that specifically were involving him. Those were my thoughts. I agree with what Alice said as well, by all means.
And I agree with what he said, because when he ran it in our game, he made certain it was influencing the world. And I think they could have done a much better job, like, you know, showing like a kid getting angry, you know, and having that flare in the eyes when he looks in the mirror or something, or just something to tie it into, you know, an uprising in the world of the sins. But they didn't.
Okay, cool. Interesting take. Thanks. Have you folks seen Captain Marvel?
Yes, we have.
Yes.
And by the way, we wore this Captain Marvel shirts, our Captain Marvel shirts, as a joke, since, you know, we were doing Captain Marvels.
Oh, nice. Sweet. Okay. So who wants to go first?
I feel so embarrassed. I'm wearing a shirt. I grabbed the first shirt I had from Joe's Crab Shack, and it has "bite me" in huge letters. I feel so out of step now.
Well, you should be on camera so we can see it.
Oh, no. Believe me, a look into my face would just destroy the show's ratings forever. You know, first thing I do when I meet somebody, I apologize for my face. No, we're way better off. We're way better off looking at the lantern symbol.
It sounds like you are destined for public education. I mean, if you've got a face like that, your new class comes in. And
Well, the late great Christopher Hitchens once described politics politics is show business for ugly people. And as a political science professor, that's something I've always taken to heart.
All right. Well,
Chris, why don't you give your review first, since we've reviewed another movie already?
Okay, well, okay, Captain Marvel. Like I said, the actual dude Marvel guy was a hot mess. His book, it might have gotten good if somebody would have written it for longer than three issues, but it never really gets that good. Having read them all, it kind of peaks when Jim Starlin, I think, may have had relatively speaking, the longest run of anybody, and he told the only story that Jim Starlin ever writes. Hey, it's Thanos, and he's trying to get X object and mess up the universe. But since that was like the first time he told it, it was better than like the 87th time that he's told it now. So as far as like dude Marvel, very, very, very little there I think they could have made a movie out of. Now, Carol Danvers. Carol and I have a huge history. I still remember getting Ms. Marvel off the newsstands back in 77. And little 8-year-old, 9-year-old me could not have been happier, because it was something new. It was a Marvel comic with a female lead, and I dug that so much. And I read it, and it's about a woman starting a new career in the publishing industry. And I even then knew I wanted to be a writer. So I'm like, we have the same dream. And they have her working for J. Jonah Jameson. And really, if the book is partly about establishing your character's feminist bona fides, could you ask for a better foil than J. Jonah Jameson? Oh, it was great. And I loved that book to pieces. And it just broke me. It was one of the books I don't want to make it overly dramatic. But, you know, that comic going away is one of the things that put me off comics for about 15 years. It's just, and then of course, if you know Carol's history, it was her turn to be a hot mess, you know, with the whole losing her memory, and now she's binary, and now she's this, and now she's, you know, best forgotten, I think. So to me, the movie to make would have been about Carol breaking into the publishing business and, you know, either take advantage of that Sony deal and have her work for J. Jonah Jameson, or make up your own J. Jonah Jameson. I really do not understand at all the choices about starting her off as a cipher, because regardless of who's playing the role, you basically can't play the role for the whole first part of the movie because you have no memory. And I just, it's a choice that just baffled me throughout the film. And it's automatically starting off in what is already the weak point of the Marvel Universe, one of their fantasy kingdoms. And those are hit or miss. You know, I mean, they can be as spectacular as Wakanda, or they can be as groin-punchingly terrible as Atalan was in the Inhumans series. And, but I mean, the Kree homeworld, it was just kind of there. And it's all tell, don't show. So really, I think that, you know, whatever else happened, I think it had by far the weakest beginning of any Marvel movie I've ever seen. I mean, that was a pretty tedious 10 or 15 minutes. Now, it gets a lot better when Samuel L. Jackson shows up, because let's face it, every movie gets better when Samuel L. Jackson shows up. And it finally gives her somebody to play off of. And I thought, you know, that's where it kind of peaked, is when she had Jackson to play off of. And then she recovers her memories, and it gets better. But You know, they also want to work in, like, we want to be the Ready Player One of the 90s. And, you know, I want, a side opinion. I once had the flu, got out of bed, and stepped on a nail. I enjoyed that more than Ready Player One. Okay, so yeah. You know, trying to be Ready Player One of the 90s is not scoring any points with me. Although it wasn't terrible. I think the only time that it was too much for me is when she's in the big fight scene and they start, and I've been sitting there for like an hour going, ah, I can't wait till they play I'm Just a Girl by No Doubt. And then boom, there it is. That's when it's like, now I want to hurt you, movie. You've hurt me and I want to hurt you back. But it passed pretty quickly. I didn't hold a grudge for long. And so at the end, it was aggressively okay. I didn't feel like I wasted my money. I didn't hate it, but it's one of the runts of the Marvel litter. I didn't come out feeling transformed by the experience because I thought they could have made some better choices with the character. And I think they could have made some better choices just with their, just cinematically speaking. Although, hey, props to the guy who played the amiable Skrull guy. I thought he was good.
Jude Law?
No, the Skrull, not the Kree, the Skrull.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I thought he was a good presence in the movie. So yeah, it's not the movie that I would have made. Now of course you can't talk about, you know, you can't just talk about this thing on its merits as a film. You have to talk about the symbol that it has become. And you know, if I had a dime for every time I had what was the one where Carol is drinking this the cup of like fanboy tears. Yeah, it's become something more than the movie itself. And honestly, this is the part where I really like the film better than the film itself. Because again, I am a weirdo. I spend a lot of time with Joan Crawford, Barbara Stanwyck, and legendary Hollywood actresses. And when if you come to me and say, it's a movie with a strong female lead, I'm going, yes, and? But this film, I think, really woke me up to the fact that somewhere between, you know, by the time that you know, they added sound and color to movies. Somewhere in Hollywood, they sort of lost, for whatever stupid reason, the notion that a movie with a strong female lead can be a good movie that people will go see. And if this wakes Hollywood up to the possibility that, yes, we absolutely need more women with female leads, then I think it'll be a great for that reason, even though, like I said, on its own terms, not that great a film. But if it gets more female-led movies made, then hey, I am all about this film. And apparently it's going to make happen the dream that I have had now for a decade. We're finally getting a Black Widow film. Because to me, Black Widow, especially the way they have done her in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, has way more potential than Captain Marvel ever did. I think Black Widow we can defend as having a strong female lead and actually being a good movie. So, okay movie, fabulous symbol.
I actually enjoyed the movie more than you did. I don't have the same level of history with Captain Marvel or Ms. Marvel as you do by any means.
I'm old.
But what I will say is there were definitely some scenes. The first 15 minutes, I was like, this movie's going to suck. Same as you. I will be very honest with you about that. And then it got a lot better for me, and I really appreciated a lot of what they did. I think that some of the aspects that I really did not appreciate, though, and I apologize for anybody this might offend, but I have a long history of learning and watching and dissecting martial practices. And it was very clear that unlike Jennifer Gardner, who went through a lot of training to try and at least be decent at fighting in the film, they did not take that work with Brie Larson. And
the film being...
Elektra, yeah. Because she worked her ass off for it. So no matter what else you think about her depiction, she tried really hard to do the martial arts. For Brie Larson, it really showed that they didn't really spend any time working on her fighting skills. And so because of that, they cut several fight scenes that were mismatches of chaos just to hide that, because they weren't necessarily using a stunt double during those scenes. And those scenes gave me a literal headache. It was just like, oh, where's it going? Oh my gosh. You know, I was just like, but as a whole, I think that there were some very positive elements to the movie. I think that they did something I liked what they did for it was they made believable villains. And that's uncommon in superhero comics and superhero products, you know, from it's very hit or miss. But in this case, I think they did a good job of believable villains. However, I do agree with you. The Kree thing was really, really tell, not show. And it was really poorly done on that.
Yeah. And I have a great deal of sympathy for Roy Thomas's take that, you know, trying to turn the Skrull into these migrant victims, it sort of defeats his original metaphor of two great conquering empires locked in this pointless war. But I guess maybe that's just a sign of the times. You know, Thomas was writing in the middle of the Vietnam era, and the message of like two empires locked in a pointless and futile war, I guess maybe that carried a little more weight then. So it's not an update that I hate, but I kind of respect Roy Thomas's opinion as well. I think that would have also been a valid choice.
I agree with that.
Thank you.
What do you think, Brendan?
Sorry, had to go to my unmute button. I liked the movie a lot. When the movie started, I was gripping my seat handles in fury, going, "What the crap is this? Why are we on the Kree home world?" You know, but it is a reveal, and unfortunately, those first 15 minutes did not play that well. You know, the waking up from the dream, the, hey, why don't we fight because we can't sleep? I completely agree with Alice, and I'm the one that, when we were talking about it after we saw it, agreed with the terrible cuts in the early fights that are trying to be physical, because I was literally in the theater just trying to puzzle out what the crap is going on the screen, and you know, it was not great. However, as the movie progressed, it really did pick up a lot of steam. I thought it was one of the better Marvel movies as of late. You know, I love Infinity War. Homecoming's Michael Keaton is fantastic. And Ant-Man and the Wasp was just a great time. Before that, it had been a while since I'd found one that I really liked. Black Panther was just okay to me. Guardians of the Galaxy and Thor Ragnarok really just aggravated me. This one, I had a lot of positive experience. I walked out of the theater with a really good time. And I avoid all previews. Alice and I try, and as soon as we know we want to see a movie, just avoid previews. So literally, when I'm sitting down in the theater before, I've got my ears plugged as soon as I identify a movie, and I close my eyes to try and just avoid any spoilers. What I heard about this one, though, was that it was the new, you know, feminist movie or something. And going through it, I really didn't find that message that some people were super happy about, other people were really aggravated. Because it's not a feminist message, it's a message of empowerment for people. The person that they're telling it about happens to be a woman. That's it. And that doesn't make it a feminist message. That just makes it a message that a woman is the main character of. And I liked that message of empowerment. The humor I thought was well placed in the movie. I loved the Veer, her name, they call her Veers throughout a lot of it. And I thought that was a really good reveal. I didn't catch on to that being just part of Carol Danvers' name. I would say the weak point of the movie was unfortunately the main character's acting. I just did not dig Brie Larson's acting. And the high point of the movie, I would say, is Maria Rambeau's speech. I thought that actress did an absolutely fantastic job when she was talking with Carol in Louisiana. Phil Coulson and Nick Fury were great to see in it.
I'm sorry. Oh, go ahead, please.
Go ahead. Okay.
You sure?
I agree with what Brandon was saying. I just wanted to add to that a little bit. You know, walking out, it was a much more uplifting experience than when we walked in. It just definitely improved. But what I wanted to add to him, to his statement about the feminist message, I'm not really a feminist. I think that, you know, there's lots of things in the world that's overdone on. But That was definitely a movie about empowerment. And as a woman, I've been through a hell of a lot worse than what they highlighted. And I know a lot of women who've been through, excuse my language, sorry, through much, much worse than I have, sexism-wise. And those, the things that she went through, some of that they highlighted, some of it could have been done to a guy. A lot of it could have been done to a guy simply because, it, you know, a guy who's a little bit runty or whatnot, wanting to go through flight school, stuff like that. A lot of that stuff could have happened to a man just as easily. It just happened to be a woman. They did not overhit on the feminine thing because they would have done a lot worse if they did.
Yeah, we have an explicit tag, by the way, on iTunes, so you can cuss if you want. It's okay.
Well, you know, and it reminds me of I think I just to expand on your point. What I thought was one of their weaker filmmaking choices is, you know, like I said, in my head, it's Carol going to work for J. Jonah Jameson, and that's how you see that she's discouraged and has to deal with things. And if you want to impart your feminist message, it's right there. It's inherent to the story. Trying to do them as flashbacks, especially like really rapid cut flashbacks, I thought that's a very risky female filmmaking choice, because you, whether it's a female message or a male message or whatever, that's really tough to convey what you need to convey with that choice. And so the way that the Captain Marvel filmmakers did it, I just felt like I was being punched by memes. You know, I just didn't feel like there was any depth or consideration to it. And I came away feeling like they want to make a strong statement about being picked on and discouraged, one that's there for everybody. But they chose to do it in a way that was way beyond their skills. I felt like memes were punching me. I was sitting here thinking, like, these are things that have never happened to anybody ever in this way. And I just thought that was unfortunate, because that they apparently expected that was going to carry a lot more film than it was capable of. I keep thinking about things like Star Trek VI, random example. They want to make a statement about prejudice. And the great twist in Star Trek VI is you find out the guy who's leading the anti-Klingon conspiracy is freaking Brock Peters from To Kill a Mockingbird. That's a shock. That's a twist. That's something you're not expecting. And it's built up over the course of, you know, an hour 40. You know, but I mean, you know, some guy popping in going like, "You're a girl." It just, and no. There are just such better ways to do this as a filmmaking choice. So I appreciated what it tried to do. I just, and goodness knows, people being picked on and discouraged from your dreams is something we should all be able to relate to. But this film, I just, you know, its reach exceeded its grasp on that point.
I agree with the memes aspect. Like we've already talked about a few areas where they did bad cuts. I think that overall the story that they told, you know, had redeeming qualities, and I enjoyed it. But the punching in the face with memes, there were certain flashback cuts that were definitely like that. I think there were some extended ones that weren't. But to go with, to add to your being punched with memes, if they were going to do that, they did it also in an incomplete fashion, because, mm-hmm. you know, the fall down 7, get up 8 kind of sentiment at the end. And when they were flashing back to show each of them getting up, the most important ones didn't get up. They didn't flash to her in flight school getting up when she was down. Yeah. Those were really important major points, turning points in her life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for some reason it was only the little kid versions of her that we saw getting up.
Yeah, and that was disappointing.
And as to the flashbacks, the thing that I thought they actually did really well on them is a different area. It's when the Skrulls are plundering her memory. And I thought that scene was really cool, because at that point you're like, wait, what exactly is going on? You know that they're kind of looking in, but you're hearing this voice and not certain exactly everything that's going on. And just like, as I think it's Ben Mendelsohn is the Skrull.
Thank you. Yes.
And, you know, he's like, are we sure that we have the right person, you know, and just trying to figure out. And you're getting kind of clued in and see, you know, that Wendy Lawson is, you know, an important character, but you haven't really met her yet and such. And so it was really, I thought that one was handled really, really well.
Yeah, I just I lament how, you know, if they had gone with publishing Carol, we could have seen we could have experienced these struggles with her, and they could have built them up over the course of an hour and 40 minutes, and then we would have felt like we would have been more invested in her journey if we could have shown her struggling with working for J. Jonah Jameson or a J. Jonah Jameson type. And Lord knows, if you want to make comments about the state of women in the workplace, that's going to be a much better storytelling venue and a much more resonant place to do it than the rapid cut flashbacks that they opted to. I just unfortunate choice on their part.
I agree with you, Chris, but I will point out one reason they didn't make that choice. Like all of us have alluded to throughout different podcasts, including this one, a lot of this kind of stuff is being tailored so that people who have no idea about comics or superhero stuff come in and they can enjoy a movie and then be introduced to it in theory. And I mean, I have friends who are not geeks at all, and they go, and because of this burgeoning superhero comics, movies, they're like, I totally understand you now. I'm like, no, you don't understand what it is. But I appreciate the sentiment. And saying that, we've recently been introduced to the character you're talking about in the form of a mediocre Supergirl. And that's saying, because it was a bad Supergirl, now it's a mediocre Supergirl. And so that entire plot line is literally being run in a mediocre Supergirl that everyone's being inundated with. And if they bring the publishing version to the theater right now, everyone's going to call them a copycat, because most everyone doesn't know about the history that some of us do.
Well, that is a fair point. I don't watch the Supergirl, but honestly, you know, given the audience for a Marvel cinematic movie versus a show that's running on the CW, is that whatever it's called today,
yeah, CW.
I'd take that gamble, especially since you say that it's mediocre. I mean, as a longtime cinephile, to me, it's like, you know what justifies a remake? If you can do it better. And really, I think I would trust the Marvel people to do most things better than anything DC related these days.
Oh, and yes, Maria Rambeau was her scene about, you know, what pain really is and loss of friends. But the picture of the screen share right now, the Flurrigan was the best part of the movie.
Yeah, and you know, that kind of symbolized it for me, you know, because I love dogs and I like cats, and this was clearly a cat movie. I don't think it was necessarily aimed at me, but I don't begrudge it that in the slightest. I'm happy that we live in a world that has both cats and dogs, and everybody can find the thing that works for them.
Chris, I don't think you're that much of a weirdo, because you sound as weird as Brandon and I. So either we're really weird people, or you're just really, really normal. I'd like to think that you're just really normal, because you seem just as weird to me.
Well, I think you're total sweethearts. I already love you two a lot. So there you go.
I can say
that in return.
Well, hey, on that happy note, we should probably wrap up, because my kid's going to be home from school in about 5 minutes.
Do you have any quick thoughts on the movie, Mike?
I'm looking forward to seeing it when it comes to streaming.
Awesome.
Oh.
I've been a fan of the comics. I'm curious to see what they do. I was excited to see Greg Clarkson again, Agent Coulson. And I had a feeling that he and...
He's awesome.
Yeah. I kind of wanted to see it before the Avengers come out. I don't know if I'm going to have a chance to, though. So, oh, and apparently a new Avengers trailer just dropped this morning. So, have you guys seen that yet?
Nope. Something we avoid trailers, avoid, as we said.
Oh,
completely,
that's right.
Avoid all trailers.
Yeah, I got up about an hour before the podcast, so no.
Gotcha. What is this like teacher conference week, or what's going on there?
I'm on spring break.
Oh, okay. Ours was like last week. Okay, cool.
So I was up till 6 a.m. I found a lost film noir called Too Late for Tears, and about this housewife who becomes this completely ruthless killer in a heartbeat, and it was just magnificently over the top and delicious. So, and then next thing you know, it's 7 a.m. So yeah.
Are you talking about that black and white movie from like the 1950s or 1940s?
1949 with Elizabeth Scott and
Ben. I saw that a long time ago. It was a fun movie.
Oh, I love you all the more. I've met somebody else who's seen this film. You're awesome.
Chris, it was a really good movie and very memorable to me.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
So out of curiosity, Chris, have you ever read Brubaker's Criminal comic?
Sadly have not. I think I'm honest about the fact that for me, comics are a nostalgia trip. I mean, there are some comics with like great artistic merit, but to me, I just want to feel like I did when I was 8 or 9 years old and spinning that spinner rack around and just saying, please show me the one that will take me the furthest away from rural Virginia.
I just, you mentioned that I know noir is a big thing for you. Criminal really has that feeling, and The Fade Out, the comic he did about 3 years ago. It's set in Hollywood, I want to say in the late 40s. And it's very much got that film noir feel. It's out in a graphic novel now, so if you get a chance, The Fade Out by Ed Brubaker and Sean Phillips is worth a look.
Well, thank you for the recommendation.
Hey, no worries. And with that, any closing thoughts from anybody before we wrap things up?
Now looking forward.
Go ahead.
Looking forward to our Endgame podcast.
Yeah, we have to get that on the books. That's going to be a big conversation.
Yes.
Maybe we should combine that with a because Walt was saying we should try to mix our pop culture conversation with our gaming conversation. Maybe we should talk about how you run that kind of a cosmic world-ending encounter.
Pee breaks. Lots
I
of
agree.
Pee breaks.
I agree. Oh, and we definitely need Chris in on the panel when we talk about rock, paper, scissors, because I really want to do that episode because I really want to teach people that not every single character should be a brick.
That is fair. And Chris knows superhero comics, so I'm sure you can speak to that.
You're very sweet. Thank you.
And right system, so you know.
All right, guys, I need to wrap up. Thanks to all our panelists for coming out. Thanks for Walt for saying hi and taking out to walk your dog. and actually, Walt is watching us on YouTube right now as he walks his dog, and he's typing comments in the chat. So,
aww.
Hey, Walt, how you doing? And to all our listeners, thanks for checking out the Banff Podcast, and we'll catch you next time.
Bye, everyone.